Amen. Welcome. My name is Elliot Cherry. A few things before we begin the sermon portion of our worship service. The first is that several of you asked, and it happened at the 9 o'clock too, why is your top button buttoned? And I just need you to know it's not a fashion statement, okay? I don't make fashion statements. I just don't like the way that it looked when it was like open, you know? It was like one of those like butterfly looking collars. I was like, but some of the nine said, you kind of look like Justin Timberlake. And their words, not mine. I kind of see it. So just if you're wondering, that's what's going on. The second thing is, way more importantly, is tonight we are having a congregational meeting for our members. So you've heard about this over the last 2 months. I hope it's a huge deal. It's huge news. Non-members are welcome to come. We'd love for you to join us. We'd love for you to be a part of the evening. It's happening at 4 o'clock at our Waverly Belmont location, just down the street. It's where we did our Easter services, 4 to 6-ish, we hope, maybe before then, maybe 4 to 5:30. There will be two items on the agenda for the night. The first is our new assistant pastor who started last fall, Ben Hooper, is officially being installed tonight, which is some denominational polity language of he's been a pastor for a long time, but we are installing him officially as our assistant pastor here. It's a little long overdue, but it's finally getting done. So that'll be the first part of the evening. It's a big deal. It's an honor. It's a joyful thing. And then somebody doesn't think so. Then the second part of the evening is when we will move to a vote to purchase this corner. You've probably heard the news, but we are under contract with the owners to own this whole corner, which is an enormous piece of news. We've long waited, long hoped, long prayed this would be the case. We are now under contract with the owners to purchase the entire corner. Got a lot of people working on a lot of things for this future, but none of it is actually official until the members of our church vote to approve it. That's in the contract. So this is our to vote to own this piece of property. So would love for you to come and approve that motion, approve that movement. You could vote no. And I would just say you've not prayed about it as much as we have if you vote no on that. But please come and vote your conscience. But we need you to vote in the affirmative. So we need our members to come and vote tonight. We have to have a certain amount of them there. Hundreds of you all have registered. Matt, can they come even if they haven't registered? Yes, please come even if you haven't registered, but it would help us on a head count if you could register online for the member for the congregational meeting tonight. So tonight at 4 o'clock, please come out. We're now moving into the sermon portion of our worship service, and we have been studying the life of Jesus in the book of John. John is the fourth book in the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. John gives us a display of the life of Jesus that is so unique apart from Matthew, Mark, and Luke. They all weave together to paint a complete picture of us for Jesus, but John has a lot of themes in his book. One of them that we've been walking in this year and will continue to through the fall even, up until around November, is this theme that John presents to us that Jesus is the misunderstood Messiah. Everywhere Jesus goes, he's not just misunderstood in the sense that people aren't quite understanding what words he's using. He's misunderstood to the degree of like utter rejection. Like, you're offending us. We don't get what kingdom you're even talking about. We want nothing to do with you. And the avalanche snowballs to such a degree that they end up wanting to kill him. And they do, because he is so misunderstood. He is so isolated. He is so rejected by man that they end up killing him. And so we're looking at that thread each week. We're looking at a different angle of that. And what's interesting today is that we come to like basically the second two-thirds of a chapter. We're not going to read all of it. We're gonna kind of hop our way through it. But this chapter, as I was preparing this series last fall, this chapter is really the one that was like my gateway, my trailhead into this whole theme of Jesus being misunderstood. Like, it happens in every chapter, it happens in every interaction, but this chapter, it's not just on display, it's like what the chapter is about. This chapter is, it's not the pinnacle moment, because that would be the cross where he was so misunderstood, but this is kind of the like the fulcrum. This is the place where his misunderstoodness reaches new heights, and it's all throughout the chapter. It's kind of the point of the chapter, is how misunderstood Jesus was and is. So we're gonna be in John chapter 7, and we're gonna read three different chunks of John 7. All of it is in there for the slides, but we're gonna skip around some. So we're gonna be in John chapter 7, starting in verse 14. We're gonna read 14 through 18. Then we're gonna read 25 through 36. then we're going to read 40 through 44. So John 14 through 18, 25 through 36, and 40 through 44 as we look at how misunderstood and challenged Jesus was and is. So here we go. John chapter 7, starting in verse 14, says this, about the middle of the feast, it's the Feast of the Tabernacles from last week if you were here, Feast of the Tabernacles, at the middle of the feast, Jesus went up into the temple and began teaching. The Jews therefore marveled, saying, how is it that this man has learning when he's never studied? So Jesus answered them, my teaching is not mine, but his who sent me. If anyone's will is to do God's will, he will know whether the teaching is from God or whether I am speaking on my own authority. The one who speaks on his own authority seeks his own glory, but the one who seeks the glory of him who sent him is true. And in him there is no falsehood. Now skip down to verse 25. Some of the people of Jerusalem therefore said, is not this the man whom they seek to kill? And here he is, speaking openly, and they say nothing to him. Can it be that the authorities really know that this is the Christ? But we know where this man comes from. And when the Christ appears, no one will know where he comes from. So Jesus proclaimed, as he taught in the temple, you know me, and you know where I come from. But I have not come of my own accord. He who sent me is true, and him you do not know. I know him, for I come from him, and he sent me. So they were seeking to arrest him, but no one laid a hand on him because his hour had not yet come. Yet many of the people believed in him. They said, when the Christ appears, will he do more signs than this man has done? The Pharisees heard the crowd muttering these things about him, and the chief priests and Pharisees sent officers to arrest him. Jesus then said, I will be with you a little longer, and then I am going to him who sent me. You will seek me, and you will not find me. Where I am, you cannot come. The Jews said to one another, where does this man intend to go that we will not find him? Does he intend to go to the dispersion? That's the diaspora. That's the Jews scattered amongst the Roman, formerly Greek, but Roman Empire, not in Jerusalem, not in Israel. Does he intend to go to the dispersion among the Greeks and teach the Greeks, the Gentiles? What does he mean by saying, you will seek me and you will not find me, and where I am, you cannot come? Now down to verse 40. When they heard these words, some of the people said, this really is the prophet. Others said, this is the Christ. But some said, is the Christ to come from Galilee? Has not the scripture said that the Christ comes from the offspring of David and comes from Bethlehem, the village where David was? There was a division among the people over him. Some of them wanted to arrest him, but no one laid hands on him. It's the word of the Lord. Amen. Okay, so a riot is brewing in this scene. It's kind of like in a movie scene, if you can remember, like imagine like a New York Stock Exchange moment or like a town hall meeting where like everybody's yelling over everybody, no one's listening to each other, anger is mounting, chaos is increasing, and in our context, misunderstanding is multiplying. Like no one is getting what's going on. And the issue here is that there's people in the crowd, the Jews and the Jewish leaders, who they have certain messianic certainties. They have certainties over what they think they are certain must be true about their Messiah. Now, here's what's interesting about this. All the certainties that they present, things they are certain about that must be true of their Messiah, none of them are scriptural. They're all man-made. They're all made-up certainties. They're all things that they have decided must be true about their Messiah. And so an easier way to say this, or a summary way to say this, is what are their messianic certainties, or what are theirs? My Messiah would nevers. They're MMWNs. My Messiah would never do this. I'm so certain that what you're doing, Jesus, is different than what I expect and demand my Messiah to be. My Messiah would never do the things you're doing. My Messiah would never say the things you're saying. I'm so certain about my perspective and my perception on what a true Messiah must be that I've got some questions for you, Jesus. I've got some challenges for you because I'm not quite sure you are the Messiah because I've got a list of my Messiah would nevers, and you seem to be doing a lot of them. And so here's how they come through. They come through in their questions to Jesus in this chapter. They are not curious learner questions. They are not like, oh, tell us more, Jesus. We really want to understand. These are challenges to Jesus. And so the first one that comes through in verse 14 and 15. This is at the very beginning. It says, about the middle of the feast, Jesus went up to the temple and began teaching. The Jews therefore marveled, saying, how is it that this man has learning when he has never studied? Break this board in half. How is it that this man has learning when he has never studied? That's what they used to say about me. I'm kidding. Here's what they're actually asking about, and I want to show it to you. They're asking about authority. We see this in the way that Jesus responds to them, because Jesus says this word authority several times in his response to them, because here's what he's saying. They had this rabbi tradition, this rabbinical tradition, when they say, how is this man so learned when he's never studied? Here's what they're saying. How does this man have rabbi authority over us when we don't even know the rabbi that he studied underneath? In their tradition, if you wanted to become a rabbi, you had to go to a rabbinical school. You had to study under a certain rabbi. And then as you grew in your learning underneath that rabbi, over time, that rabbi would literally, like, not just disseminate teaching to you, they would be handing off authority to you. The Jewish word for this is shmiha. So shmiha was the Hebrew word for authority. Every rabbi was handed down from the rabbi before them, or the rabbi tradition they came from, the shmiha of the rabbi they studied under. And so when they challenge his studiedness, they're not saying, look, you didn't even go to an Ivy League, dude. What they're saying is who gave you your shmiha, bro? You don't even have any shmiha, dude. Like, you don't have any authority to teach us. You don't have any authority over us. You're pretending like you know everything, and no one even gave you authority. So there, my Messiah would never, is they're saying, my Messiah would never use authority over me that I don't find legitimate. My Messiah would never teach me things with authority of a rabbi that I can't even, like, check the source of and see who gave them that authority. That's the first one. Second one comes through in verse 26 through 27. It's an interesting one. Starting verse 25, actually. It says, some of the people of Jerusalem therefore said, is this not the man whom they seek to kill? Verse 26, and here he is speaking openly, and they say nothing to him. Can it be that the authorities really know that this is the Christ? But we know where this man comes from, and when the Christ appears, no one will know where he comes from. It's very interesting. No one will know where he comes from. How can this man be the Messiah if we know where he's from? That's what they say. So here, it's an interesting one because they're questioning his origin. So I'll write that down. But really what they're questioning is his mission. And here's how they explain it. Because if you read a little bit further, we read it towards the end of our time, our passage down in the 40s, like 43. They say, like, we thought the Messiah was supposed to come from Bethlehem. They know he's from Bethlehem. So the question is not, is it possible that we would know the birth city of our Messiah? They knew that. There were prophecies in the Old Testament that said the Messiah will come from Judea, the Messiah will come from the tribe of Judah, the Messiah will come from Bethlehem. So when they question his origin, they're not saying, we didn't think we'd know the birthplace of the Messiah. Here's what they're saying. They say, when the Messiah appears, we'll know it's him. So here's what they're saying. In their mind, their certainty was, when the Messiah's here, he's going to get up on that horse and he's going to lead the revolution and he's going to kick the Romans out. There will be no question that the man that we call Messiah is the Messiah. And so this man, Jesus, who's kind of claiming to be the Messiah, we know where he's from. He's from Bethlehem. He was his father's apprentice. He was a carpenter. He was raised in Galilee. Like, we know too much about this dude. We know where he went to elementary school. Like, we know all this stuff. Why would we be questioning our Messiah? Because when our Messiah comes, when the one that we want is here, there will be no, like, maybe it's him, maybe it's not. Like, how? Like, we know he's from Bethlehem, but why is he not leading the revolution that our Messiah will certainly lead? They're questioning the mission of this Messiah. Why is he not getting busy with the things that my Messiah needs to get busy doing? My Messiah would never, here's what they would say, my Messiah would never be doing things that don't fall in line with the kind of mission that I have for my Messiah. He wouldn't be wasting his time. It comes through when they say when the Messiah appears, because here's what they're saying. In their mind, they were certain that he would poof into the reality of the political revolution they wanted, and he would just appear, and like that train would already be moving. So they don't want to have any wonderings of like, well, wait, is it or isn't it? He's just going to appear and start overthrowing the Romans. Not this Jesus. We know where he's from. We know what he's been doing, and he hasn't been doing our Messiah's mission. Third thing they challenge, third certainty they have about him, comes in verse 30 through 31. It says, so they were seeking to arrest him, but no one laid a hand on him because his hour had not yet come. We'll talk about that in a minute. Yet many of the people believed in him. They said, when the Christ appears, will he not do more signs than this man has done? Here's what they're saying. Up until this point, Jesus has displayed his power. a couple of public miracles in the last few chapters. The first one was in John chapter 5, a big kind of public ministry where he heals the man by the pool at Bethesda. It was a crowded place. But then in John chapter 6, one chapter earlier, he feeds the 5,000. He displayed his power. He did a sign and wonder to show how divine he could be and what power he could do. But now they're going, well, wait, hold on. When our Messiah appears, when my Messiah appears, he's going to use his power to do things that I want him to do for me all the time. When my Messiah appears, I'm certain that he'll be doing like bread magic tricks all the time. I won't ever need bread anymore when my Messiah appears. And so maybe this is the Messiah, but when the real Messiah appears, won't he be doing more signs in this? Won't he be doing like more miracles in this? Won't he be directing his power to make my life go a certain way? Won't he be like using his power in the way that I think he should be using his power for my life? So they're MMWN, they're my Messiah would never. My Messiah would never not use his power the way that I want him to. My Messiah would never not use power to make my life go a certain way. Challenging his power. And then the last one is a little bit buried, but it is very much on display. This is not the only place this challenge is on display, but this is what they say. Look at verse 33 through 36. Jesus said to them, I will be with you a little longer, and then I'm going to him who sent me. Talking about his Father. You will seek me, and you will not find me. Where I am, you cannot come. The Jews said to one another, where does this man intend to go that we will not find him? Does he intend to go to the dispersion, like the diaspora of the Jews among the Greeks and the Gentiles, and to teach the Greeks and the Gentiles, the non-Jewish people? What does he mean by saying, you will seek me and not find me, and where I am, you cannot come? Okay. When Jesus says, where I am going, you cannot follow, and then I'm going to the one who sent me, that's a Jesus shorthand way of saying what's going to happen in like the last month and a half of his life, which is his suffering, his betrayal, his death, his resurrection, and his ascension back to the Father. It's kind of capturing the last page of his earthly life. I'm about to go through something that you guys can't follow. I'm about to go bear something that you guys cannot bear. I'm about to literally walk through hell and you can't go there with me. It's mine to bear. And so what he's saying is, and what they're challenging is their view of their Messiah's suffering. And here's how they respond when he says, I'm going somewhere that you can't follow. They go, he's talking about his suffering. I'm about to go through something that you can't bear up underneath. And they go, are you talking about geography, bro? Like, are you like, where in the world is Carmen Sandiego-ing? Like, we'll find you. Here's what they're saying. In their mind, for their Messiah, what they were certain of is their Messiah was going to come lead such a mission, such a revolution, that wherever their Messiah went, they would be able to follow him. What do you mean you're going to go somewhere that we can't go? You will always be reachable by us. You will always be followable by us. You will always be understandable by us. And in their paradigm, guess what that included none of for their Messiah? None of suffering. They were certain that their Messiah would never suffer. Why would the Messiah who had come to lead a revolution ever need to suffer? You're not here to be killed. You're here to kill. So why would you, why, my Messiah has no category for suffering. My Messiah would always be reachable and understandable by me. So those are four main challenges to him in this section. And we'll spend a little bit of time on this in a little bit, like in a couple hours when I'm finishing up. But I'm kidding. But all of Jesus' rebuttals are really interesting. And we don't have time to go through all of them, how he like responds to each of these. Here's what he is saying, though, in each of them. Essentially what he says in response to them is your challenge of my authority, your challenge of my origin, my mission, your challenge of my power, and your challenge of my suffering. You need to know this. All that stems from the one who sent me, my Father. And it's God the Father who you don't even know. He says that. You don't even know him. You're his people and you don't even know him. But I get all my authority, I get my mission, I get my power. I have my road to suffering because all that is coming from my Father. All that's coming from the one who sent me. So doesn't it make you a little irked? Doesn't it tee you off just a little bit? That with all these certainties they have of him, all their my Messiahs would nevers that they have of him, he doesn't even really answer them. He doesn't even really like play their game. He doesn't go like, well, yeah, let's talk about that. And I want to help you understand. He just says like, yeah, you don't get it. And it's the one who sent me. I hope you can like make sense of that. I'm not doing what you think I should be doing. I'm not playing on the rules of the mission that you think I should be on. I'm here for a different reason. It all comes from the one who sent me. And that drove them crazy. And we can look at it like 2,000 years ago and look at first century Jews and think like, man, they just really didn't get it. But what about us? Like, what happens when Jesus doesn't bow down to our certainties of him? Like, these were their messianic certainties. What are ours? What are our my Messiah would nevers? And the first one that I want to talk about, but I don't want to spend too much time talking about it, it's an easy target. It doesn't mean it's not real. It's very real for some of us in the room. But I don't want to give too much attention to it, not because it's not important, but because I don't think it's actually what is in the heart of this passage, but it is in here, or it's in the heart of us, is we all have a certain degree of my Messiah would never as it relates to our politics. And there are some people in the room who would say like, well, my Messiah would never vote Republican. And there's some people in the room who would say like, my Messiah would never vote Democrat, and you're both right. And there's this reality of like, when we tie our allegiance and we put a certainty on the Jesus of the Bible and we assign a my Messiah would never to a political party, we're really getting close to, I don't know if I'd talk about it that way. But moving on, because we're not really going to talk about that this morning. You should with Jesus if you have a my Messiah would never that's politically charged. But we're going to go to a little bit more personal place. I'm sure that's personal for you, but I want to go like, I want to go deep in how you feel personally about the Jesus as it relates to your my Messiah would nevers. For me, maybe the most deeply cemented my Messiah would never has to do with my belief that my Messiah would never ask me to suffer. And it's not just that he would never ask me to suffer, he certainly would never ask me to suffer on something that I don't like approve of, that I don't sign off on. He would never ask me to love someone that's hard to love. He would never ask me to pay a cost that's uncomfortable for me to pay, like an emotional cost or a relational cost or a financial cost. He would never ask me to love the poor or the needy or the marginalized or the victims of injustice in this city. He would never ask me to like walk through the valley of the shadow of death. He would never ask me that, especially if he hasn't like gotten my like approval and sign off for it yet. He would never ask me to walk through that kind of road that could like gut me and rip me out. And he would never do that to me. My Messiah would never. And then if you go another layer deeper and you go, okay, maybe he would ask me to suffer some ways and take up my cross. He certainly would never ask me to do that and then not explain himself. Like he would never ask me to walk through a valley. He would never ask me to walk through a hard season. He would never ask me to like walk through a marriage. He would never ask me to walk through a tragedy and then not tell me why he's asking me to do it. He would never do that. He would always at least make sure I understood, make sure that like, oh, I see now like this heartache, if you kind of build the bridge, it's going to land in this beauty. Okay, I'm good with it now. Now that I totally understand why you're doing what you're doing, now I'll walk across this bridge and into this valley because of what you've explained to me. My Messiah would never not explain my suffering to me. And then if you keep going, and you can even make a little bit of peace with like, okay, he's asking me to suffer and I may not always know why. This is maybe like the deepest part of this root if these are all interconnected to a degree. If you've walked through suffering, if you've walked through heartache, if you've walked through tragedy and sadness, my Messiah would never do all that to me and then not repay me for what he owes me. Like, I've suffered for him. I've lost a lot. I've been through some things. And so he now owes me some things and I'm kind of waiting on him to like dote out the blessings that I think he needs to be doting out because my Messiah is in my debt. If he's gonna ask me to suffer and walk through hard things and then not explain it, he better have something waiting for me that I deserve from him. My Messiah would never not repay me for all that I've done, for all that I've obeyed. I've been so good. I've done the things he's asked me to do. I've like I've honored, I've done my best, I've followed him. Now he owes me some things. He owes me a life that is full of blessing. He owes me a life that has less and less suffering. I've done all this for him. Now what's he going to do for me? Like, please don't sit through this passage and hear the uproar of the Jewish people and judge them for their messianic certainties without looking at your own. And here's what, I kind of wrote this on my whiteboard in my office. And then I was like, oh, shoot. They're the same. We have all the same messianic certainties. Now, maybe not in the same order. But when you look at the authority, here's what I began to realize about, like, they were challenging his authority. They were challenging what he wasn't. Like, you don't have a right to teach me and, like, be above me. Here's what we're saying when we're saying that. You better use your teaching authority to explain to me everything you've done. Because if you don't do that, then I don't trust your teaching authority. You better be using your teaching authority to make sure I can understand all that you're doing and I can track with you on it. Where's your smiha? I don't know if I trust you. I don't know if I really like the way you're explaining that or not explaining that. And then if you look at their mission, like, they had a deeply felt political mission for their Messiah. Their Messiah, their messianic certainties were deeply political. And so they had this expectation that our Messiah will do political things. And by the way, our Christianity does deeply impact the political world. I'm not saying that. We're not devoid of that. What I'm saying is your kingdom, as it relates to your political agenda, are you laying that back on top of this Messiah with a certainty and saying, hey, your mission, my Messiah would never not be on my political mission for the world. And then if you look at power... How angry are we when he doesn't use his power to make our life go a certain way? Like, dude, you fed 5,000. Dude, look at what you've given that person. Look at the job you've given them. Look at the inheritance you've given them. Look at the blessings you've given them. Why are you not using your power to repay me what you owe me? Why are you not using your power to give me the life that I deserve from you now? And then this one, again, it's pretty easy to connect these dots. But I don't want a Messiah that suffers, because if I follow him, that means I'm going to suffer too. So I don't need my Messiah to be suffering, because if I'm staying close to him, that means I'm going to suffer too. So my Messiah would never suffer, because my Messiah should never ask me to suffer. And when these messianic certainties are threatened, which is what's happening in John 7, when these messianic certainties get threatened, everything's at stake. And I don't mean that hyperbolically. Everything's at stake. It's so serious for them. They're so offended by Jesus not playing by their rules and doing what they think he should be doing that they want to kill him. They will kill him. And so it should be noted by us is that if we're unwilling to part with our certainties of him, we may also at the same time simultaneously be missing him. Like, your certainties of him do not preclude you. Do not set you up well to be able to then experience him deeply. If you want a true encounter with him, if you want to experience Jesus in all of his beauty and his fullness, you may have to put down some of your self-made certainties of him if you want to truly experience the king of this kingdom. One way I believe it could be said is that with messianic certainties, with my Messiah would nevers, is no intimacy. There is no intimacy with certainties of him. And really, certainties meaning my man-made, self-determined assumptions of what he has to do. When you come to him with these and the my Messiah would nevers, you will not experience any intimacy with him. It doesn't breed it. How could you ever have intimacy with the Jesus that you're angry at for not doing the things that you think he should be doing with his authority and his mission and his power and his suffering? There's no intimacy when we bring our certainties, our man-made certainties to him. So, if that's our certainties and our my Messiah would nevers, what's going on the other half of the board? Because I want to look at this. This is also in the passage. If these are our self-made certainties, what are the true realities of Jesus? Or here's how I said it. What are the true Messiah's alwayses? If my Messiah would nevers are self-made by me, what are Jesus's true Messiah's always do this? Well, like we said earlier, when we kind of get into Jesus' rebuttals to these things in the passage, they're challenging his origin. Where'd you even train at? Where do you get your smicha? Where do you get your authority? They're challenging his mission. Like, when my Messiah appears, he's going to be doing political things for us. They challenge his power. Why is he not doing more signs and miracles? They challenge his suffering. Where are you going that we can't follow? All those things Jesus answers throughout this passage over and over again by saying, do you know I have been sent here? He uses this phrase 9 times in this passage. 9 times he says to them, like, the one who sent me, the one who sent me, the one I come from, the one who sent me. I now am going back to the one who sent me. He's talking about a father in heaven who sent his son on a mission. The father sent the son on a mission. And in this passage, this is his answer to all of this. This is how he gives the rebuttal to all of their challenges of my Messiah would nevers. He's been sent on a mission from the one who sent him, his father. He's not here to play our games or meet our demands we have of him. He's here with a different agenda, installing a different kingdom, here to accomplish the task of a different master that's not us. He's been sent by his father, not by us. And at the end of the section, he says to the crowds, and we already saw this, he's been sent, and where he says he's going, he says, you can't follow. And we've already said that that is his shorthand for, I'm going through a road, I'm walking through a hell, literally, that you can't follow me there. It's mine to bear, not yours. I'm going there. And then, in the, maybe the most powerful line of the whole section, if you go back to verse 30, throw this up there, verse 30. Try to imagine what this would have been like experiencing this in real time. They were seeking to arrest him, but no one laid a hand on him because his hour had not yet come. Like, what was that like? In this like New York Stock Exchange chaos of the temple, everybody's shouting things at him and challenging him, and all he keeps saying is, my father who sent me, you don't even know my father, by the way, but he who sent me, he's where I got my authority. He's where I get my mission. He's why I use my power, and he's why I'm going to suffer. All this is from my father who sent me, my father who sent me, the one who sent me, the one who sent me. He's making them irate, and they want to kill him. They want to arrest him. And what does it say, though? But they couldn't yet, because his hour had not come yet. This is one of the gospel writer John's favorite words, his hour. It doesn't mean 60 minutes. It means a stretch of time that is always talking about, again, just what the place you can't follow, it's always talking about his death and resurrection, his suffering, his passion. So this group of people wants to arrest him and kill him. And in verse 30, it says, but they couldn't, wasn't his hour yet. Like, did he have a force field around him where like they're trying to come grab him? And like, it'd be amazing. Or like all of them just get diverted away. I don't know, but it's amazing to think about there's a mob of people who wants to arrest him and kill him and they can't. Because it's not his hour yet. And all of this happened. He was sent to a place that we couldn't follow for an hour, a time of his suffering that would lead to his death and resurrection. All of it was because he was dead set on the mission his father had given him. He was dead set, no pun intended, on the mission his father had given him, which means this: true messiahs are always, always driven by love. Always. The true messiah is always driven by love. Love is what kept him focused on his mission. Love is what kept him dead set on the place where he would go that we couldn't follow. Love was what kept him locked into his hour that was coming. It would be very soon after this. He would not be driven by our political allegiances. He would not be driven by our demands of him. He would not be driven by our ability to comprehend or understand all that he's done and is doing. He was driven by love. And this love, like, not only is it otherworldly, not only is that love so dead set on us that, like, we couldn't even make him stop loving us, but it was so driven by love that, like, you will hold on to all of these with him until you are melted by this. You will keep all of your certainties of him, of what he can and can't do, of what he should and shouldn't do, until you know that he was driven by love for you. And this love will lead you to wild places. Assumptions of him, man-made certainties of him, They blind us to the magic of a wild Messiah that we can't contain. But if you stay committed to your certainties, your my Messiah would nevers, you will never experience intimacy with him. It's like not possible. It's oil and water. They won't mix. But if you want to experience the love of that Jesus has for you, if you want to experience deep intimacy with him, you have to put down your certainties of him. Not because you have to earn it from him, but because your grip will be so tight on your my Messiah would never is that you will not actually be able to receive the love that he has for you. So I've been listening this week to Noah Kahan's new record. That's why I buttoned my top button. Kidding. Noah Kahan, he lives nearby, I'm told. So maybe he's here. Hey, Noah, what's up, man? It's a great record. It's a great record. I think it is, at least. And I've been listening to it a bunch. But he's got a way of like putting words to how we all kind of feel. He's a great artist, great lyricist. But he's got this song. It's the second song on the album called Doors. It's a great song. I'm also dying to know, by the way, how many breakups did he go through before writing this album? Because it's either like 100 or one really bad one. Because it's all about him not having someone. But this song, it's a great song, but it's essentially him telling someone who's trying to love him. He's essentially saying like, here's all the reasons I have for why you should stop loving me. Here's all the things that are like broke about me. Here's all the reasons, like here's all the doors you're trying to get into, but I won't let you get in there. Like the closer you get, the more I'm gonna lock up. Like I'm really hard to love, so you should probably just like leave now. Here's all the reasons I have for why you should stop loving me. And if you've been listening to Jesus this morning, the one who was sent by his Father, here's what you'd hear from him. Here's what you'd hear about him. Is it like Noah, we keep throwing reasons at him for why he should stop loving us, and he receives none of them. We keep giving him evidence for reasons why like he should give up the chase. We keep telling him, not just with our sin and our rebellion, but like with our pride and our demands that like, this is the Messiah you have to be or else I'm out. And he would say, yeah, and none of that stops me from wanting to love you. We keep giving him certainties to live by and he bows down to none of them. And thank God that's true. He's on a mission sent by the Father to a place that you and I could not have followed him. And that place that you and I could not have followed him, his hour, he went into that place. His hour came and he was swallowed up by it. And so take all of these, like, the mission you have for him, your belief that he nor you should have to suffer, him not explaining to you, you getting from him what you think he owes you, take all of that and filter it through not just the mission that he actually was on, but his deep love for you, and hold these things up to this mission and tell me that this isn't way better than whatever certainties you have of him. Like he actually came to do something for you that's way better than whatever it is you think he needs to be doing for you. He actually took care of your deepest need. He actually loved you to the deepest place. He actually wants to heal the most wounded spot in your entire story. He wants to go to that place, and he was so dead set on it, sent on a mission by his Father, he doesn't let your certainty stop him. It's so much better that he loves you with his love than that he bows down to whatever you think he should be doing for you. True messiahs always complete the mission that their Father sent them on. True messiahs always remove us from our throne. True messiahs always build a different and better kingdom. And true messiahs are always willing to die instead of their people. He stayed on mission where he was sent. And so here's what's going to happen. I'm about to close us in prayer, and then the band's going to come up. They're going to sing one song for us to kind of sit in. And then we'll enter a time of feasting on the sacrament of Jesus. And that sacrament is all about his hour. It's all about his suffering for us. And so I would ask in these next few minutes as you prepare your hearts to come and feast on him, I don't know if these are yours. I bet they're close. I bet some offshoot of this is a place in you that you would say, my Messiah would never, and I'm so tired of my Messiah not listening to me. Is that you would take whatever it is that comes to mind, be still enough to ask the Lord to show you these places, and then filter it through what he was sent here and on mission to do. Would you receive it? Would you taste it? Would you drink it? that you might experience a deeper intimacy with him. So let's pray, and then we'll sit together before we feast. Jesus, so many places that we believe our Messiah would never or should never. You should be aligned with our mission. You should not ask us to suffer. You should be explaining yourself and using your authority differently. You should be owing us your power. Jesus, forgive us of our pride. Still us enough, we pray, in these moments. Get us calm enough, quiet enough, present enough to be honest enough about where those places are in our story, that we would loosen our grip on those places, that we might receive the feast you have for us and the deep love you've always had for your people. And thank you for being the true Messiah, not the one of our own making. We ask all this in your name. Amen.